Wait.
View.
Slideshow.
Slideshow. Well.
View slideshow.
Oh, you're just stuck.
No, that's what he just did.
So what do we do? Just wait.
Yeah.
I wait. Yeah.
So go to slideshow. Leave the cursor off the bottom areas.
No.
Away from
the
away from the bottom.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't do anything.
And now hit left and right. The buttons left and right. Although actually it may just
oh there we go.
Oh wow.
And then hit left or right.
Right.
Try
to be there. That's
okay. Maybe you on good. Try space. Yeah.
Your Mac is known for being intuitive.
Try hitting the space
button. I mean, like, one is a terrible key to
use.
Yeah, I
don't
know. No, I think that's just bad.
There we go again. Is it up and down?
I use a Mac.
I don't use
Mac.
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 Try up and down.
Okay. That's good.
I mean,
you know how to go forward, right? So just keep it.
Yeah, never come
don't
down.
Think you're
going to take
that multiple
times.
Oh.
Are we having experiments?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
That's odd.
Uh-oh.
That's good.
Did
you realize different sizes?
No.
Well, this
not
will,
here, they were.
This will at least work. You'll see you're just... up and down keys are scrolling you a little bit. But
okay.
So you just have to scroll your way slowly.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you can adiabatically win the prize.
Yeah. Okay.
This will be an interesting challenge.
All right, so it's a pleasure to be back. And what I'd like to tell you about, I suppose this is a laser pointer?
Yeah.
Okay. is how to make adiabatic quantum computing robust. So I see that not everybody is necessarily an expert on adiabatic quantum computing. So let me start with a very brief introduction to what adiabatic quantum computing is. And I was told by Alyosha that I could give a technical talk. So this will be a fairly technical talk. I hope it's going to be OK. And if not, then stop me and ask questions. So what is adiabatic quantum computing? Well, it's an alternative paradigm for performing quantum computing, which was proposed by this MIT group. And it was originally proposed as a method for solving optimization problems. For example, FreeSat. And the idea of adiabatic quantum computing is really quite distinct from the idea of the circuit model. Rather than starting from some initial state and applying a sequence of gates, single and two-qubit gates, instead the idea is to evolve a Hamiltonian slowly from some simple initial Hamiltonian, H0, to some sufficiently complicated final Hamiltonian at the final time t. And provided we do this adiabatically, if we start from an initial state, which is, let's say, all zeros, the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian. And again, the adiabatic theorem provides guarantees that if we do this sufficiently slowly, we will get to the ground state of the final Hamiltonian, which hopefully encodes the answer to a computational problem that we have posed. So in a little bit more detail, how did you say I'm supposed to?
Down.
Yeah, OK. Good. Okay. So here it is in a little bit more detail, and this is not necessarily the only way to do adiabatic quantum computing. This is called the linear interpolation version. So we have an adiabatic Hamiltonian, and here's the initial Hamiltonian, here's the final Hamiltonian, and we pick some interpolation function, f of t, which is 0 initially and 1 at the end. And then, as you can see, this interpolation will take us from H0 to H1. And if f is a sufficiently slowly varying function, then we will always stay in the instantaneous ground state of this Hamiltonian, which for the rest of this talk I will call phi adiabatic. And then at the end, again, the final ground state will encode the solution to a computational problem. So what's an interesting example of this paradigm? If For example, you could imagine trying to solve an NP-hard problem, such as finding the ground state of a spin glass in this way. So let's say that the initial Hamiltonian is just a strong magnetic field on all the spins. Then the initial state is just all spins up. And then we could try to interpolate from this initial Hamiltonian to the final Hamiltonian, which could be a Heisenberg interaction with the coupling constants chosen at random, quenched. So we pick them once at random and keep them there. And then this is a representation of a spin glass Hamiltonian. And we know that finding the ground state of such a Hamiltonian in general is a very hard problem. So the beauty of the adiabatic quantum computing paradigm is that it seems to suggest a mechanism for finding such a ground state, provided that we evolve sufficiently slowly. And of course, the question is, how slow is slow? OK, so this is adiabatic quantum computing in a nutshell. And what I really want to talk about is not algorithmic issues, but how to make AQC robust, and in particular, how to protect it against decoherence and control errors. So what I'll do in this talk is present rigorous bounds on the fidelity of AQC in the presence of coupling to an environment, and also talk about how to perform the interpolation in such a way that we get the right answer with very high fidelity. So the main result is going to be this theorem. And the point of the talk is really to try to prove or sketch the proof of this theorem. So what does the theorem say? It says that we can perform adiabatic quantum computing with a fidelity that approaches 1. And how fast does it approach 1? Well, it has a power law in the system size. And how can we do this? Well, we can do this using only 2 local Hamiltonians, so that's Hamiltonians involving only 2 body interactions, in the presence of 1 local noise. So that means a system bath interaction where system qubits, let's say, coupled to bath operators. So it's a 2-body interaction between system and bath, no higher. And how can we do this? Well, we need to assume that we have access to pulses, dynamical decoupling pulses in particular, whose width and intervals shrink as a power law, essentially the same power law as the one over here, in the system size. So this is a very demanding requirement that we can that we can implement pulses which become shorter both in width and in intervals, so shorter and more frequent as we grow the system. So I can say right away that this is a feature of this theorem that I don't like, but it's an initial result in the direction of making adiabatic quantum computing robust, more robust than this, I hope. So this is something that will have to be revisited. But it's a proof in principle that we can make adiabatic quantum computing robust, provided that we have access to resources that become more and more powerful as the system grows. And what is this power law? Well, the power law exponent is basically determined by the dynamical critical exponent of the closed system. So this is the exponent that determines how quickly the gap closes as you approach a quantum phase transition, as you approach a critical point. Yeah, yeah. That's right, the width of the circuit, I guess.
Another adiabatic evolution with other Hamiltonian involves only 2 local interactions.
Yes.
And then you have some like quantum gates, which are those pulses.
Yes.
Okay.
That's pretty much, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, there will be a mapping. The mapping is to a Hamiltonian that was proved recently to be universal for adiabatic quantum computing as a result by Peter Love and Jacob Diamanti. So that will show up later in the talk. OK, so what is the proof strategy? I will basically, I won't have time to prove almost anything in detail, but I'd like to give you a sketch. And the idea is this. We need to define a distance between what we actually get and what we really want. So the desired ground state is what I previously called phi adiabatic. It's this idealized instantaneous ground state of the system. And the actual system state is the density matrix that describes the evolution of the system in the presence of the bound. So I would like to get a bound on this distance, delta s. And to get a bound, I'll do it very conservatively. I'll bound this distance in terms of a sum of two other distances using a triangle inequality. And the first of these two distances is what I'll call the decoherence distance, or d sub d. This is purely due to the fact that our system is open. It will have very little to do with the adiabatic evolution. It's just the consequence of opening the system up to the environment. And it, the role of the dynamical decoupling pulses that I mentioned will be to make this distance small. And then the other distance has nothing to do with the fact that the system is open. It will be due to the fact that we have to evolve adiabatically. And we can't do it infinitely slowly, obviously. So because we will be evolving it with some finite speed, we will have some deviations from adiabaticity. And those need to be bounded as well. OK, so to show that these two distances can be made small,
question. I'm trying to convince myself that these distances actually exist. I mean, I could certainly define the first one as saying, okay, suppose I have perfect adiabaticity, what do I get due to decoherence? And the second is, suppose I have no decoherence, what do I get? But when I have both of them at the same time, how do I define those distances?
I'll define them very precisely for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Promise.
Can I ask you, did you say how much slow is low
already? Oh, yeah. I will.
Ah, you will?
Yeah. Okay. No, right now it's just hand waving, trying to give you some intuition. Okay. So remember, there are these two distances. The idea of proving that we can make the closed system adiabatic distance small is to essentially prove the adiabatic theorem. Okay, and then the adiabatic theorem has been proven over and over again for the past 80 odd years. So we'll provide another proof, which is particularly suited for our purposes, where we get a very strong bound on this quantity, the adiabatic distance. So I'll talk about that very shortly in detail. And then the what I call the decoherence distance, that I will show how to make small using dynamical decoupling pulses. Okay, so the talk is basically divided into two main parts. First, the delta adiabatic, and then the decoherence distance. And in each case, I would like to show you how to make these distances small, and then we'll have to make that compatible. Okay, so I need to introduce a couple of very standard tools. The distance that I've been talking about is the trace distance between states. So the trace distance is just the trace norm of an operator. In this case, the operator is the difference between two density matrices, rho 1 and rho 2. And I'll also have an occasion to do this between pure states. And then I'll use this notation for pure state psi 1, psi 2. The trace distance is by no means the only way to measure the distance between states, but it's fairly well agreed upon that it's a good measure. It can be interpreted as essentially the maximum probability of distinguishing between the states rho 1 and rho 2. Okay, so this will be my distance measure between states. And then I also need the operator norm, which is just the standard, essentially maximum eigenvalue or maximum singular value in case the operator is not Hermitian. But we will always be dealing with Hermitian operators. So operator norm is just the maximum eigenvalue of an operator. OK, so those will be two important tools that I'll be using. And now let's move on to the first part, which is to quantify the adiabatic distance. OK, so we need to go to dimensionless units. So I'll work with tau, which is the actual time divided by the final time. And in those units, we can rewrite the Schrödinger equation like so. OK, so Again, tau is a dimensionless time. And now the goal of adiabatic quantum computing in this closed system setting, or the goal of the adiabatic theorem, is to minimize the distance, the trace distance, between the actual state, so psi is the solution of the Schrödinger equation, and this instantaneous eigenstate at the final time. So this is the definition of delta adiabatic. Okay, so question is how to make this distance small. And what determines the amount of time with which we have to evolve? So if you open up a textbook like Messiah, you will find an answer. And this is essentially the answer that Messiah has given following Born and Flock and many decades of work on this. The answer is we can bound the fidelity, which is related to the distance, the trace distance. There's a simple inequality relating the two, so we can talk as well about the fidelity. Let's say that we want a fidelity that's better than 1 minus epsilon squared. Well, then Messiah tells you that you need to evolve for a time which is greater than this quantity. So what is this quantity? We have the error, epsilon. And then the denominator is the involves the gap, 1 over the gap squared. So this is the minimum gap encountered as we proceed along the adiabatic evolution. And in the numerator, we have the matrix element of the derivative of the adiabatic Hamiltonian, which makes sense because the derivative of the adiabatic Hamiltonian measures how fast the evolution proceeds. And then this is like a transition matrix element between the adiabatic ground state, instantaneous adiabatic ground state, and a relevant excited state. The excited state, the first excited state, which is associated with this gap. So this is the textbook criterion. And it works quite well. But unfortunately, it's not really rigorous. So there are certainly examples that violate this criterion. Basically, it's neither necessary nor sufficient, but it's a good kind of back of the envelope criterion we can often use. So I'll talk about how to fix it. The one other thing I want to mention here is we will need this for what comes later. In many cases, the gap scales. Scales like some inverse polynomial in system size, and what I previously called the dynamical critical exponent. But by that I mean the way that the gap, the minimum gap, scales as a function of system size n. And I wrote here for efficient quantum algorithms. Actually, this Grover is an efficient algorithm, and the gap scales exponentially down. So I shouldn't have really said efficient here. But second-order quantum phase transitions are typically described by this kind of polynomially inverse polynomial scanning gap. First-order quantum phase transitions are typically characterized by exponentially inversely exponentially closing gaps. Okay, so we'll have to remember this, that the way that the gap scales with system size. So now, as I said, this criterion is actually not quite right. And there are people in the audience here who have contributed to fixing it. Interesting. There we go. Okay. So one way to fix it was proposed by Janssen, Roskaj, and Seiler recently. And their adiabatic theorem can be stated as follows. Let's assume that the ground state manifold of the adiabatic Hamiltonian is gapped. So the gap is delta. Let's assume that the adiabatic Hamiltonian is twice differentiable on the time interval. And let's assume that the first derivative at the initial and final time is 0. What they proved under these fairly mild assumptions is that in this case, for time that scales like the operator norm of h dot squared divided by the gap cubed, if I put some time dilation factor r here, I can get an adiabatic distance that scales like 1 over r squared. OK, so this shows you that by evolving sufficiently slowly, let's say that that the interpolation is given, let's say that the gap is given, if I make my time twice as long, I will make the error 4 times as small. Okay, so this is one way to show that you can make the adiabatic error small. Another way was worked out in this paper with Alyosha and Ali Razahani. We make stronger assumptions, but we also get a stronger bound on the adiabatic distance. So assuming that we have a non-degenerate and gapped ground state, and assuming that we have a Hamiltonian which is analytic in a strip that has some width gamma around 0, 1. So here I'm referring to an analytic continuation of the Hamiltonian. And assuming that not just the first derivative, but the first n derivatives of the Hamiltonian vanish at the initial and the final time. So here's a, sorry? N is a parameter you pick.
Okay.
You design. Okay, so you just pick as many derivatives as you want to be zero at the initial and the final time. So here's a picture that describes what I just said. Here's the real time axis, imaginary time axis. We analytically continue the Hamiltonian into the complex plane. We assume that there's a strip of some width gamma. And what is gamma? Gamma is simply the distance to the nearest pole of the Hamiltonian. So provided the Hamiltonian is analytic in the strip, and provided that we have a gap, under these assumptions, what we showed is that the following. Let's pick some parameter s to be greater than 1. S is arbitrary, and we can try to optimize it. And in fact, we have in the paper. But let's let s be greater than 1. So if the time scales, again, like h dot squared over delta cubed, that's the same factor as in the Janssen et al. Version. But now we have this freedom of picking n first n, the first n derivatives to be 0. And again, gamma was the width of the analyticity strip. So provided we pick the time like so, or should really be greater or equal than this quantity, then we can make the adiabatic distance go down a lot like 1 over r squared, if you remember. R was the dilation factor in the Janssen et al. Version. We can make the adiabatic distance, the distance between the actual and desired ground state, scale like n to the minus n, which is faster than exponential and faster than factorial in n. And again, n is just a parameter that you control. It's the number of derivatives of the adiabatic interpolation Hamiltonian that vanish at the initial and the final time. So by making the interpolation analytic and very constant initially and finally, very determined by this parameter n, you can get a very accurate final state.
Distance only two points, right? Yes. So, I mean, if you have a Hamiltonian which is, you know, sufficiently close, basically, to the Hamiltonian you are using to evolve, the evolution should be very similar of one and the other, just because Schrodinger equation is just, you know, first order, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for the other Hamiltonian, I don't have to request pretty much anything. I could make, you know, like, suppose that you have set the evolution in Hamiltonian path, right? And now I take another Hamiltonian which oscillates, you know, over this one,
mm-hmm.
and you know, but it's very close one to another. The evolution should be very similar. However, I don't have to request anything on the derivatives.
Well, your intuition is misleading you, is all I can tell you.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So,
but actually, yeah. Maybe to turn around this argument. I mean, if you have any given Hamiltonian, it's already clear that the first derivative vanishes at these endpoints. Is it maybe then not true that you can find another Hamiltonian pair where also higher derivatives vanish at these endpoints and which is very close to the original one, so that physically it shouldn't make any difference? So, I mean, then you, I mean, this would be good for you, but maybe too good to be true. How can I understand? Or is it just not true what I'm saying? Can't you find a smoother path close to any given one?
The point of this, one of the important points of this result, and I'm sorry, I'll have to move on and try to answer your question and then move on because I have a lot of ground to cover, is basically that the path doesn't matter at all. And this is, except for the initial, well, really except only, except for the final time.
It's just one point.
Final Hamiltonian. That's right. There is some magic that comes from the analyticity requirement. The analyticity requirement allows you to use Cauchy's theorem, and Cauchy's theorem relates the nth derivative to the first derivative, the nth power, and this is very strong. Okay, so maybe I should have stressed that analyticity is really important for this proof. Without analyticity, the proof doesn't work. Okay, and the reason that Jensen et al. Didn't get as tight a bound is because they didn't demand an analytic Hamiltonian. Yes?
So I know you want to move on, but this is, I think, really interesting, so I hope you
okay.
forgive another
sure.
question. So there are functions with compact support where all derivatives vanish at the endpoints.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be bad. Then we'd have a constant Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah,
then we'd have a constant Hamiltonian.
No, there are. So are those functions proven to be non-analytic?
Yes,
well, analytic, you have the power series.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's right.
Analytic, you have the power series. So if all derivatives are zero,
yeah, you can develop the function around the point where all the derivatives vanish, and then it's a constant function.
Then it's zero.
It's zero, actually.
Or constant.
Okay.
So it's important for us that the Hamiltonian has only a finite number of vanishing derivatives, otherwise it would be constant.
So given that I can at least construct analytic functions that have arbitrarily many derivatives,
right.
Zero, what I'm wondering is how this connects to experiment. If I do an experiment, the math, I mean, what I have is an experiment. None of these derivatives will literally vanish in the laboratory, right? How do I connect this with doing an experiment?
Yeah, so this is why I presented the Jensen version as well, which only requires that the first two derivatives, just the first derivative vanishes. In that case, you get a much weaker bound. So basically, there's a trade-off between the number of vanishing derivatives and the tightness of the bound.
I mean, I think there may be some hidden subtlety with the time here, in that if you have a lot of derivatives that are zero in the starting and end point, that means you're staying there for a long, you're kind of leaving it very slowly, right?
Yeah.
Is that it takes a long time to accelerate to get up to your...
Well, that's quantified in the independence here, in the time.
Right. Right. That's right. Okay. Maybe I was wrong to say it's hidden, but it's certainly not evident in the discussion here, right? Because that your cost of making n very large is at the time is going to end up very large.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's not really very large because you see, you know,
if you know,
you see that the trade-off is a mild polynomial in n versus a better than factorial improvement.
Right.
Right. So,
but there is a cost. Anyway.
There is a cost. Yes. Okay. So, yes.
Comment. Just, I'm not sure if I agree with the comparison with the circuit model, since you're still dealing with the closed system here.
Okay.
So I hope you get back.
You didn't let me get to this line. So let me say what I have to say, and then tell me if you agree or not. Okay. So So in this line, I want to say that this is an advantage of the adiabatic quantum computing paradigm, and of course. You have to compare apples to apples. So I'm only making this comparison in the context of closed system evolution. Okay. So what is the advantage that AQC has in the closed system setting? Well, let's talk about the circuit model for a second. And let's not have a bath, but let's imagine that our unitary gates have errors. So there are some, let's say, angle inaccuracies. So let's say that you try to do a pi over 2 rotation, but you do pi over 2 plus epsilon. Not due to coupling to a bath, which means that you expand Hilbert space, but due to the fact that you didn't turn your knob quite right. Okay, so in that setting, we know that errors in the circuit model will accumulate. Let's say that these errors are random, then they will add up like a random walk. That is not a problem in the adiabatic quantum computing setting, because we don't care what the path is. The path from initial to final is fairly arbitrary. The only hard constraint is that the final Hamiltonian has to be right on.
But then, how much control you need to ensure that the Hamiltonian is analytic up to that aspect?
Yes. Analyticity is not really a big deal. And remember that it is set by this parameter gamma. Right? So I need analyticity on the real axis. And then I do need to assume an analytic continuation into imaginary time, and gamma is exactly the width of this analytic strip, analyticity strip. I don't think analyticity is such a big deal. I think the vanishing derivatives is a much bigger deal.
So
if you have anything, sorry, anything remotely stochastic happening now,
right.
How is that going to affect analyticity?
Right. I don't think it will affect analyticity, but it will probably affect the vanishing derivatives. Yes. But if you have anything remotely stochastic in the circuit model, closed system circuit model, that means you have some stochastic error in your case. Right? So then you need to invoke error correction in order to fix that. And here, we're not invoking any error correction, at least not in any visible way. There's no concatenation of codes or anything like that. There is no code. This is not really anything new. When the holonomic quantum computing model was proposed, the quantum computing with geometric transformations, this was the same observation that when you do things adiabatically, there is an insensitivity to path.
Okay.
It's just the only point I'm trying to make here. I certainly am not claiming that this is some new observation that we've made. This has been known for a long time. The only issue is that we've quantified the error, and we've shown that this is a pretty good design criterion to pick an analytic Hamiltonian with n vanishing derivatives, because we can prove that the error gets to be really small in such a set. Okay, so that's what I meant to say here, that this is really a set of design guidelines for an experimentalist trying to perform adiabatic quantum computing. Okay. So now, this is all I wanted to say about closed systems. Now, a much harder problem, in a way, is, of course, the open system setting. So this is just a summary of the standard definitions for open systems with one feature that I want to point out that's special to what I will talk about. So here's the total Hamiltonian that describes a system plus bath. And we have the system Hamiltonian, we have the bath Hamiltonian, we have the system bath interaction. And I'm thinking about a generic system bath interaction. And now the system Hamiltonian will be decomposed into two parts, two time dependent parts. One that implements the adiabatic quantum computing, that's what I was talking about so far. And then another part which will implement dynamically coupling pulses. So this will be my error correction, active error correction. Control. And what is important is that I will have to enforce that the adiabatic, the computational Hamiltonian, commutes at all times with the dynamically coupling Hamiltonian, the error correction Hamiltonian. So the computational and the error correction Hamiltonian will have to commute. And I will talk later about how you can accomplish that, but the answer is you need to encode. Okay, so basically this, you can think of this as a stabilizer normalizer type of construction, or maybe more generally as a subsystem code with a commutant, that kind of construction. That's actually the construction that I'll be using later. So for now, let's just accept that we can make the computational and the error correction Hamiltonian commute. Okay, so then this is the propagator for the joint system bath evolution. And this is the time-evolved joint state. And the system state, the actual state that describes the evolution of our system, is, as usual, traced out the bath. So now, remember this distance inequality that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk. I would like to give a sketch of where it arises from. And if anybody is interested in the more algebraic version of this, then I can do that later. So, okay, I want to prove this inequality. The inequality is that the distance between the actual system state, that's the trace out the bath, and the desired system state, so this is what I call delta S, is upper bounded by the adiabatic distance and the decoherence or decoupling distance. So I've talked about the first one in detail, the adiabatic distance. So how can we prove such an inequality? It's really nothing but the triangle inequality. So let's start from here. This is the actual system state at the final time. And how do I get this actual system state? I have to trace out the bath from the actual joint system bath state. So blue circles will be in the system bath Hilbert space, and red circles will be in the system only Hilbert space. And then the letter D is for distances in the joint system bath Hilbert space, and the letter delta is for distances in the system only Hilbert space. Okay, so this is where we want, this is what we actually get. But this is what we want. What we want is the system state under adiabatic, purely adiabatic evolution. So this is ideal adiabatic evolution. And the zero means that I'm assuming system and bath are decoupled. Okay, so this is a fictional object. It doesn't exist in reality. Decoupled system bath, purely adiabatic evolution. And if I go up to the joint system bath Hilbert space, then I'll just remove the S subscript. So this state is just the tensor product of the ideal system state with the bath state.
Alyosha, if you could tell me how to stop this, I would appreciate it.
Maybe if you
have to go to, well, that's what.
What's that?
Gosh. Definitely suggest plugging
in. Yeah. Do you have a power cord in your computer?
Yeah, I'll just keep hitting it.
So the power cord, we stop that?
It's okay.
Yeah,
okay. I'll just keep
it.
Okay, so this is the ideal state in the joint system bath space. This is the actual state, and here is another fictional state. This state is the decoupled system bath state. So rho zero again means decoupled. I'm assuming that system bath interaction is being switched off. But I'm not assuming adiabatic evolution here of the system. Okay, so this state is just a tensor product of the system state with the bath state, assuming that they evolved completely undecoupled. Okay, now, if I trace out the bath, I get a pure state for the system, because system and bath didn't evolve over here. And if I trace out the bath here, I get the ideal adiabatic system state. Okay, so this distance is a closed system distance. There is no bath involved here at all. This is the distance between the Schrodinger evolved system state and the ideal fictional but desired adiabatic state. So this is what I call delta adiabatic. Okay, now the only partial trace which actually makes a distance smaller is when I take the actual true joint system bath state, and I trace out the bath, and I get the actual system state. So this partial trace is a distance shrinking operation, and the desired distance delta s is the distance from here to here. Now, if you stare at this picture, you see that because of this triangle, this inequality is actually satisfied. Okay, so we have delta S is upper bounded by the sum of this leg of the triangle and this leg of the triangle. Okay, so that's basically the proof of, yeah.
The only thing that worries me about that is that it seems to be assuming that your control fluctuations, errors in control, et cetera, have no effect on the bath itself. If they do, then the partial trace going in the lower left-hand direction could also reduce distance.
No. This okay. I'm suffering from not having. I'm trying to be very pictorial here, but if I showed you the definitions, you would see that this is completely formal. There are no approximations here, no assumptions. This is just a triangle inequality.
So suppose that phi AD and psi of t are identical. The control Hamiltonian fluctuations of the control Hamiltonian.
Sorry, which? Phi AD.
Yep, and psi of t.
Yes.
Those are identical. The control Hamiltonian induces no errors on the state itself. But nonetheless, fluctuations in the control Hamiltonian could make the state of the environment different, right? And in that case, the two red dots would be identical. There'd be no delta AD. But because the state of the environment would depend on the fluctuations in the control Hamiltonian, rho naught AD of t and rho naught of t would be different. In other words, if your control Hamiltonian is also causing the state of the environment, even when the environment doesn't get entangled with your system, to change. And that seems like a reasonable, at least, you know, thing to consider.
Okay.
just shut me down if you don't want to answer the question.
I think you're forcing me to either move on or show you the algebraic manipulations, because I assure you that this is just definitions. It's just playing with definitions and the triangle inequality. There's nothing more to it.
I mean, the control Hamiltonian effects just the system, and those are cases where they're not coupled to the system back, right?
If you assume that. It seems physically unlikely, but...
Well, no, it's not assuming that in general, but I thought that was what the particular definitions of these quantities were for.
It is true, the control Hamiltonian, I assume it affects only the system.
Oh,
yeah, okay.
That's one.
Sorry, then maybe that's the better answer. Okay, so, all right. So, proven. Okay. Now, the only point that I wanted to mention was why the partial trace shrinks a distance. And this is only because it gives me an opportunity to introduce another picture into this talk. Taking the partial trace, which is what the left-hand side is, makes the distance smaller. Why is that so? Well, as Nielsen and Chuang pointed out, here's again a proof by pictures. So here's the state after partial trace, and you know these two are pretty indistinguishable. But before the partial trace, they are actually rather different. Okay, so you see that taking a partial trace, of course, is equivalent to erasing information. If you erase information, then you make distances smaller. Okay, so that's why it was that one arrow that made the distance smaller is due to this effect of information erasure. Okay, so hopefully you at least partially believe me that this distance inequality is true. It is a very convenient inequality because it allows me to separate the task of bounding the desired distance by thinking about two completely different problems. One problem was the adiabatic evolution in a closed system. The other problem is the not necessarily adiabatic evolution, distance between a decoupled state where the system and BAF are not interacting and the actual state where they are interacting. So that's the reason that I'm insisting on looking at things this way. It's also a very conservative way of upper bounding the desired distance because it's a triangle inequality, and it may very well not, this bound may very well not be saturated. But nevertheless, I can show that under certain assumptions, I can upper bound this quantity by something that goes to zero as system size gets larger, and therefore the desired distance can be made as small as we wish. Okay, so what I need to do, I already talked about how to make this distance small. I need to talk about how to make this distance small. And to do that, I'm going to invoke dynamical decoupling, which is one way of doing it. I don't know of another way, but I imagine that there could be other ways. And the one thing to realize is that this is really an optimization problem, because if I make the time larger, of course that favors making the adiabatic distance small, right? The longer I evolve, the more accurate the adiabatic evolution will be. But on the other hand, you expect that if the time gets larger, then the BAF will have more time to act, and therefore this quantity d sub d, the distance between the decoupled state and the actual state, will get larger. Okay, so there's a competition between these two terms, and it is an optimization problem which I haven't really solved, but it's sufficient to find a bound that works for both of these terms. And that's what I'll show. Okay, so onto a dynamical decoupling. Which is the tool I need in order to make the d sub d distance small. And here's a very quick intro to dynamical decoupling. Dynamical decoupling is just the idea of applying pulses to the system as opposed to the BAF. You apply some controls to the system in order to try to decouple it from the BAF. And here is the simplest version of this. Let's imagine that I could find some unitary p which anti-commutes with the system BAF Hamiltonian. So P acts on the system alone. And let's say that we found such a P that it anti-commutes with the system BAF Hamiltonian. Well, all right, so let's time evolve under system BAF. Let's apply the pulse, P, time evolve again, apply the pulse again. And now you can lift P and P dagger into the exponential. But because PH P dagger is minus h, then I get this minus becomes a plus, and now you see that these two cancel. So the idea here is nothing but walking forward and then walking backward. Okay, the minus sign that is induced by this purported pulse here is like time reversal. So one way to understand dynamical decoupling is that it induces a time reversal on the system bath evolution. And if we can do that, well, walking forward backward, we go nowhere. So that's why you get the identity here. Now, there are many simplifications hiding in these couple of lines. And I will address these simplifications. Before I go there, here's a simple example to illustrate. Let's say that we have a pure dephasing system bath interaction. So we have sigma z acting on the system, and there's some bath operator. And what is the pulse that I need to pick, p, in order to time reverse this interaction? Well, if I can apply an x pulse, which is like pi rotation around the x-axis, then because x and z anti-commute, I get the time reversal operation. So that's what this would look like. I would time evolve for some time tau, apply an x-pulse, time evolve again under this Hamiltonian, again apply an x-pulse, and I would have accomplished this walk forward backward operation where I have decoupled system from bath. Now, as I said, there are many simplifications hiding here in this, and it's deceptive due to these simplifications. So the first thing to point out is that I've assumed here that the pulses have zero width. In other words, when I wrote the operator P, which is supposed to be a system-only operator, I ignored the fact that, in fact, the system bath interaction is on while the pulse is taking place. So the finiteness of the pulse width will always spoil this type of identity. And the other thing that I'm ignoring is the fact that everything here is time-dependent Hamiltonians in practice. And therefore, you really have to do a correct time-dependent treatment, which means that you have to write a time-ordered expansion, and then you get commutators. And that's what I mean when I say that this is only true in the first-order magnitude expansion. And in fact, there are commutators involving the generators of these transformations, and these commutators are not going to be zero, and they need to be properly bounded. So that's the task. And to show that this kind of a scheme, when you include the finiteness of the pulses and the pulse intervals, you can still get a bound that is sufficiently good. Okay, but before going to these bounds, here's a more general version of dynamical decoupling. So let's say that we have a system bath Hamiltonian, and let's say that we pick a group of pulses, G sub I, and let's apply them in this manner. So first pulse, and then free evolution under the system bath Hamiltonian, and then the first pulse again, and then et cetera, cycle over this group. So when I said first order magnitude expansion, what I meant was that to a first approximation in tau, to first order in tau, you can rewrite this product of unitaries as the exponential of the sum. And the idea of dynamical decoupling is to symmetrize the system bath Hamiltonian, or to project it into the commutant of this group. So if we pick these pulses, the g-ions, which are unitaries, in such a way that this sum is zero, then you can see that to first order in tau, the effect of this evolution is the identity operation. But again, there will be higher order terms, commutators, between the different objects here. So these will be corrections that will be higher order in tau, and those need to be bounded in order to get an appropriate distance bound. Now, one very nice thing is that for a single qubit, it turns out that the Pauli group is sufficient to decouple it from an arbitrary system bath Hamiltonian to first order in magnets. Okay, so ignoring these commutators that I was talking about. If you simply symmetrize over the Pauli group in this way, and you can use some simple Pauli identities to get this shorter sequence, it's easy to convince yourself that you will decouple your qubit from an arbitrary system bath interaction. Okay, and this just comes from an appropriate number of pluses and minuses that that cancel in this Hamiltonian. It's easy to check.
Is it critical that the G's be a group as opposed to just a unitary one design?
No, actually, it's not critical. Yeah, but if they are a group, then you can think of this as a projection into the group commutant. They don't have to be a group. You can also use random pulses. Random symmetrization will also take you to zero. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So this is the general scheme of more general scheme of dynamical decoupling. But again, it still suffers from these problems of essentially approximating the pulses as having zero width and ignoring these commutators that spoil this idea because you have higher order terms here. So in order to deal with these corrections, let me introduce a few definitions, and then I'll present some bounds without proving those bounds. So dynamical decoupling I view simply as a sequence of k pulses that we apply to the system. And again, they could form a group, not necessarily, which are designed to reduce the effective system mass coupling. And I'm going to assume that they're implemented via some control Hamiltons. And I remind you that I also assume that this control Hamiltonian commutes with the adiabatic evolution Hamiltonian. Otherwise, these two will interfere. The dynamical decoupling will interfere with the adiabatic quantum computation if we don't have the computation condition. OK, so in the standard setting of decoupling, these pulse sequences are simply repeated periodically. So you cycle over this group of k elements once, and then you do it again and again and again. So that's the only setting that I'll consider for now. OK, so we have some parameters that define this problem. We have the pulse width, w. We have the pulse interval, tau. And then we have the cycle time, which is just the number of pulses k times the width and duration and intervals between pulses. So this is the time it takes to apply one cycle. And then we can repeat that cycle L times. And L times the cycle time, of course, is the total time. So this T, this capital T, is going to be the same as my adiabatic time that I was talking about before. OK, so now to present the bounds on the decoupling distance, I have to first transform to an interaction picture, which is defined by the adiabatic Hamiltonian and the Bath Hamiltonian. So let's make that interaction picture transformation. So the interaction picture propagator is the Schrodinger picture propagator, and then you time evolve backwards via the pure Bath propagator and the pure adiabatic propagator. And now here's an important idea, which comes from NMR. It's called the average Hamiltonian. I'll call it the effective error Hamiltonian. So in this interaction picture where we're moving, rotating with the Bath and the adiabatic evolution, let's define the effective Hamiltonian as the instantaneous generator of U tilde, of the interaction picture propagator. Okay, so this is not a real Hamiltonian. It's just the instantaneous Hermitian operator that corresponds to this unitary. And the norm of this guy will soon show up as an important thing. But before I talk about that, I just want to point out that in the decoupled limit is when system bath interaction goes to zero. Because we're in this interaction picture, we should just get the control Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian that control propagator that implements the decoupling pulses. And this propagator adds multiples of the decoupling time. If we did everything perfectly, every time we finish a cycle of decoupling, so every tau c, this unitary should just be the identity, right? Because we've finished the cycle, so now nothing is happening. So we have the identity transformation, which means that the effective Hamiltonian at multiples of the decoupling cycles should be zero, this effective Hamiltonian. OK, so that gives us a hint that it really is useful to look at the norm of this Hamiltonian at these stroboscopic intervals. Now, how can we compute the effective Hamiltonian? Well, you can compute it using time-dependent perturbation theory. You can do a Dyson expansion. You can do a Magnus expansion. Max expansion, I don't know if everybody's familiar, but I showed you the first term of the Max expansion. It's basically it's unitary perturbation theory. It's perturbation theory up in the exponential, as opposed to Dyson, which does things downstairs. Magnus is writing things as e to the minus I h effective and computing this h effective. So Max expansion is a way to compute h effective directly. And then because of this observation that every time I finish a cycle, the effective Hamiltonian should be zero, it makes sense to look at a quantity we call the error phase. It's dimensionless. It's just the total time times the norm of this effective Hamiltonian. If we achieved perfect decoupling, then at the final time, this error phase should be zero, right? Because if we achieve perfect decoupling, then again, it's as if the system mass Hamiltonian wasn't there, the effective Hamiltonian would be zero. So that's why we define this error phase, and we study it. And we can compute it. And the next question is, how is this quantity, the error phase, related to the decoupling distance, the d sub d that I defined previously? Well, it turns out that they're very simply related. So here again is the decoupling distance. It's the distance between the actual time-evolved state, joint system bath state, and the ideal fictitious joint system bath state, where I didn't assume that system and bath were coupled at all. So this is the quantity that I called d sub d before. And what we can show, and the proof is in this paper, is that the decoupling distance is upper bounded by a quantity involving the error phase. And in fact, you can easily simplify this inequality here. If phi is less than 1, then it's just phi itself that shows up. So we want to work in the limit where phi is small. Right? So let's assume that phi is small, is less than 1. So the decoupling distance is actually just upper bounded by this error phase, the norm of the effective Hamiltonian times the time. So from now on, we can just focus on phi. And the reason this is good is because we can get phi from the Magnus expansion. It just comes out straight from the Magnus expansion.
But then we have to show it for minutes.
Okay. So in order to present the bound, I need to introduce two norms, two operator norms. J is the norm of the system bath Hamiltonian, and beta is the norm of this is a system only Hamiltonian, this is the adiabatic Hamiltonian, and the bath only Hamiltonian. So the J is the system bath strength, and beta is the isolated system and bath. Now, this is a technical condition that we need to guarantee convergence of the Magnus expansion. And then what we can show, so remember, in order to bound the decoupling distance, I have to bound the error phase. And here is a bound in the error phase. And this is a very conservative bound. Excuse me, very lax bound. It involves the finite width of the pulse. So if the pulses were ideal in the sense that they were zero width, this term wouldn't be here. And then it involves another term, which is simply an estimate of these commutators in the Magnus expansion that we weren't able to remove because of our first order decoupling. So remember that the first order decoupling only removes the first order Magnus term, but we have all the other terms and we need to bound them. And here is bound. And due to lack of time, let me not try to explain this too much, except to note that it involves both J, the system bath coupling strength, and beta, which is the norm of the isolated Hamiltonians. Okay, so now I have to put everything together. I have to put the adiabatic distance bound and the decoupling distance together in one inequality. So to make that explicit, let me assume again that we have a polynomially shrinking gap with dynamical critical exponent z. And in order to introduce the system size, we can certainly bound beta by order n squared. N is the system size, right? So if you have two body interactions, The adiabatic Hamiltonian involves two body interactions, and this should be order n squared. And the BAF norm doesn't depend on system size. So this will be order n squared. Okay, so here, if we plug this into the adiabatic condition for the closed system, then the time is going to scale like, this is the important quantity here now, like the system size to some power involving the dynamical critical exponent. And this, all of this should be equal to some number of cycles, of decoupling cycles. Okay, so here you see the trade-off between the system size and the parameters defining the dynamical decoupling procedure. So what is given here, what is unalterable, is the system bath coupling strength, it's the energy scale for the gap, and it's the dynamical critical exponent. So it turns out that if I put everything together, I can prove the following. That if I have pulse intervals, tau, scaling like so, epsilon 1 is a free parameter. If I have pulse width, scaling like so, with epsilon 2 being another free parameter, then the decoupling distance scales like so. And the point here is to notice that I can make the decoupling distance arbitrarily small. Okay, so arbitrarily small in system size. So what's happening here is by making the system larger, I'm decreasing the distance between the decoherent evolution and the actual evolution. But of course, I pay a price, and there's a big price. And the price is that my pulse intervals have to shrink polynomially, and my pulse widths have to shrink polynomially as well. Okay, so there's a trade-off here. If you want to get a smaller distance between the actual and the desired evolution, you have to put more and more energy into this procedure. Smaller pulse intervals, smaller pulse widths. But nevertheless, this is a proof of principle that we can get an arbitrarily accurate adiabatic quantum computing in the sense that this distance and the previous distance, the adiabatic distance, are made arbitrarily small. Okay, so this is obviously not a threshold theorem in the sense of Falcone quantum error correction, because we're using growing resources here, which scale in a sense unreasonably. But it's maybe a first hint that something like a threshold theorem can be achieved. And as I comment here, for those of you who know about decoupling, dynamical decoupling pulse sequences, you know that the periodic decoupling pulse sequence, which is the only one that I used in this analysis, is actually one of the worst. And there are far more powerful pulse sequences, in particular concatenated pulse sequences, which have a recursive structure similar to concatenated error correction, except this is a recursive structure in time. And I suspect, and working on it, that by using more sophisticated pulse sequences, we can remove this poor size dependence of the pulse parameters and maybe turn this into something like log n instead of a polynomial in it. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about, which I guess I will not do, at least as part of the regular talk, is to talk about the encoding business and how to actually make this work in a specific setting of two local Hamiltonians with one local noise. But maybe I can do that in the question period. And what I'll finish with is with an almost proof of this theorem that I mentioned in the beginning. What I have shown you is that we can perform adiabatic quantum computing with a fidelity that approaches one as a power law in the system size. Haven't talked yet about how to do it with two local Hamiltonians and one local noise. And what this requires is dynamical decoupling pulses whose width and interval shrinks as a power law. And what is that power law? Again, it's dictated by the dynamical critical exponent. So this is a measure of how the system approaches criticality in the thermodynamic limit. This shows that in principle, adiabatic quantum computing can be made scalable. And the big open question is how to remove the business of resources that become more and more expensive in energy as a power law. I'd like to fix that and hear if there are any ideas out there. So thanks for your attention.
So something like 6 months ago, I remember having a discussion with I know Daniel and maybe Rolando and a couple other people somewhere off in the corner of PI about robustness to noise in AQC. And one of the things that we observed and thought about was that you can make it more robust, something like, for instance, what D-Wave is trying to do, for instance. You can make something robust against noise by increasing the energy of the whole Hamiltonian. And if your noise scale stays the same, so the gap gets bigger essentially. But of course that's a bad scaling. Even if you have power law scaling, you can't just scale up your energy linearly in your system size. Is this better than that? I'm trying to get a heuristic grasp on the difficulty of these pulses.
So why would that strategy work against decoherence?
Bernie?
Why would that strategy that you described work against decoherence? I can see that by making the gap bigger, you...
If the system bath coupling doesn't increase also.
Well, but that's the thing you can't guarantee in this way, right? Just by increasing your system gap, essentially the picture is something like this. So here's energy, and here's the ground state, and here's the first excited state, and you have some situation like this, and you're talking about making this distance larger. But if I include this system bath interaction, then the bath contributes all these intermediate levels. Right? So if you don't decouple system from bath, which is why I'm talking about dynamical decoupling, if you don't decouple system from bath, then the actual gap is not this one, which you assume you can control, it's actually this one, which is set on the system bath interaction. But you have to decouple system from bath. There's no way around it.
So it's a question. I mean, if you make the assumption that in fact your system bath coupling is of a magnitude set by something totally external to your control problem,
right.
And again, it's perhaps not physical. But if you make that assumption, then you can get some protection by this very wasteful operation of just cranking up the energy. I mean, to some degree, NMR machines do this, right? They crank up their field to get a better signal. But there's a real limit to that. It's totally not scalable because you can't just scale up your energy linearly. So even if that's a silly model, and it is a silly model, I'm just trying to figure out, is this as hard, this having your pulses, you connected it to energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out, is that as unreasonable, having those shrink linearly with your problem size? Is that as unreasonable as cranking up your overall Hamiltonian energy?
I think they're completely different things. So the pulses that I'm advocating are something like NMR pulses. Where you apply, let's say, some radio frequency field, and you need higher and higher intensity in order to achieve this limit. Whereas the gap, the intrinsic system gap, is not something that you can easily control externally. In fact, I'm not sure how you would do that in any practical setting. And how would you actually manipulate your system gap? It's an intrinsic feature of your system Hamiltonian. The one that you're trying to implement.
But the system Hamiltonian is something you create.
No, okay, so I'm talking about the fact that the system Hamiltonian has two pieces. The way that I separated the two pieces, for example, is like this. So this is the part that implements your computation. And this is the part that is implementing your pulses in my setting. And now you're talking about making the gap bigger over here. You don't have this, right? So you're just making the gap bigger over here. By making the gap bigger, I go back to this, you still have also the system bath Hamiltonian. And that system bath Hamiltonian puts all these intermediate energy levels in there. So in fact, you have a dressed system. It's dressed with these extra bath levels. So the true gap is not the one that you're, the true gap for adiabatic quantum computing is not this one, it's delta. It's actually this one, right? Delta SB. That's the one that you have to worry about. That's the one that goes into the adiabatic theorem. So if you just increase this energy scale, multiply this by some lambda, it doesn't help you with this one.
No, I don't think that's right. I mean, obviously the adiabatic theorem needs to be modified to take into account this coupling, but that small gap that you're talking about deals with excitations of the bath. And yes, so this if you run the system, it will excite the bat, but who cares? You don't care about that. You care about the state of this system.
You no, you care because you will be making transitions.
You're making transitions in the bat. I mean, in the limit, the system Hamiltonian is very large, and the system bath coupling is very small. I mean, you do some perturbation theory that says the system is almost free and the bath is almost free. And, I mean, I don't have the appropriate theorem, but it probably is true that in that extreme limit, that even though the gap on the combined system bath Hamiltonian might be very small, it doesn't matter that you still have something very close to the original adiabatic theorem.
In fact, in our paper with Alyosha and Ali, we analyzed that scenario, and the gap that we get as the relevant gap is as little. I'm not sure how you would. Maybe you're right, but I don't see how that can happen. You have these many extra pathways now to make transitions. So in order to make an error, all you need to do is get out of this ground state, and I'll start walking up this ladder.
Yeah, that's a concern.
Yeah,
that's concerning. But if the system bath Hamiltonian is very weak, I would think that will never. I mean, it's even if you walk up to very high energy levels in the bath, you won't be able to make the transition back to a higher energy level in the system.
Well, saying that the system bath coupling is weak is basically saying that instead of this picture, I have a picture maybe like this, right? Where the first bath level is much higher up.
No, because the bath itself could have very slightly spaced.
Yeah, this is not the bath. This line that I'm drawing here is the, you take the system bath Hamiltonian and you diagonalize it. Okay.
Oh,
so this
okay.
is the energy spectrum of the combined system bath. And that's the relevant energy spectrum.
No, that's not.
What matters is the release state of the system. So pretty much all the levels that you split there, I believe they should carry about the same information of the system. Now, I mean, consider a trivial case where you have two qubits and external field, and now you put it up, right? And you have some sort of Siemens 3D and stuff like that. I mean, the ground state itself is, I don't know, maybe the thing of whatever, the state of the system being zero, and you don't really care that state split because you only have excitations on the bath. As long as you follow those, any linear superposition of those states or convex combination of those states, you should be fine for the state.
But I mean, there's truth in both this, right? There's two Daniels. So what the speaker's saying is correct, that you do have, when you broaden, right, when the system bath Hamiltonian is put into place, these lines are going to broaden, essentially, which is to say you're going to get all these levels in between. Assume that the bath has a very dense spectrum or something.
That's right.
And you do have the possibility of
like
walking
this.
Up there, right?
Oh, yeah,
but
you need some space somewhere, right?
Was that?
This splits, but you need a space in between.
Yeah, I mean, but if the bath, typically you're going to have the potential to walk up there. But at the same time, if this is a Gaussian splitting, right, and then and the two energy levels, the ground and the excited state of the system, are far apart, then to get from one to the other, you're basically, it's going to be essentially a tunneling process. If those are separated by a big gap, it's going to be hard.
I think all of these arguments are correct, but my point is actually a little different. You can make these arguments, and in fact, Mohammed Amin has been making them, and you can read his papers, because these ideas are analyzed in his papers with Dmitry Afer. But you don't get rigorous bounds. The purpose of this exercise is to actually prove a rigorous bound, where you can say this distance, the one that we want, you know, is upper bounded by something, and that something I can make as small as I wish, and I've quantified the resources. So the challenge is to take the Mohammed Amin style arguments and make them into a rigorous bound. And that, maybe it's doable, and maybe you'll devise an alternative strategy.
To me, that's not the challenge. To me, the challenge is to deal with control errors.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you're assuming that your pulses are right, right, which they're not necessarily going to be. And as they get very frequent and very common, having one pulse that's off is a big deal.
Okay. So.
And making the gap bigger is not realistic, because as you increase the control Hamiltonian, errors in the control will become bigger and bigger.
Right.
And more and more.
Okay, so how to deal with control errors has two part answers. First, there's the control, not in the control errors not in the pulses, but in the adiabatic Hamiltonian itself. And that, I think, is taken care of by the adiabatic theorem. Now, your point was about
to some extent.
To some extent, minus the getting to the final Hamiltonian.
But your point was the errors and the pulses, and I absolutely agree. So I don't want to give you the whole second half of this talk, but I just want to show you. Gosh, I wish I could move more quickly through this. Bear with me. Okay. So I was talking about concatenated pulse sequences. Okay. So concatenated pulse sequences are quite good, but certainly not as good as fault-tolerant error correction. But they're quite good at dealing with control errors. Here is a concatenated pulse sequence. You take the decoupling pulse sequence that I mentioned earlier, and you insert it into itself in a recursive manner, and you come up with a concatenated pulse sequence, which grows in time in some exponential manner. Okay, so this is just a recursively defined pulse sequence. And I think you can see the rule here. And then, rather than showing our theoretical and numerical analysis of this, I want to show you experiments. This one in particular, because this is an experiment where you have real pulse errors. Okay, so this is Steve Lyon, who applied a concatenated pulse sequence on the electron of the phosphorus donor in silicon. So he was doing electron spin resonance. And what you're seeing is here is the echo intensity as a function of time. And actually, what I really want to show you is not this one, but this one. So here again, you're seeing the echo intensity as a function of time for the electron of the phosphorus donor in silicon. So the Bruce King proposal, except it's the electron rather than the nuclear spin. And what this axis actually is the normalized echo intensity normalized to the first point. Okay? And here he was implementing first the periodic version of that sequence. He used x, y, x, y instead of x, z, z, but it doesn't matter. And he did it for two input states, these plus one eigenstate of sigma x and the plus one eigenstate of sigma y. So here he repeated the periodic sequence. This is the number of repetitions, and you see that the relative echo intensity decreases. So this is a sequence, the periodic sequence, doesn't perform very well. Why? Well, among other things, it's control errors that contribute here. So then he tried the concatenated sequence, and his results are quite remarkable. This is as a function of concatenation level, which is log. Okay, so the number of pulses here is 4 to the power of this number. So this is 4 to the 4 pulses. Or it's actually 4 to the 5 pulses over. And you see that independently of the type of input state, he's able to preserve the relative echo intensity relative to the first point almost arbitrarily well. So we understand this on a theoretical level. We know why these concatenated sequences have intrinsic error correction capabilities. And I can show you the theory offline. But this shows that actually, by appropriately choosing your pulse sequences, you can deal with errors in the pulses quite effectively. So I wasn't able to come up with rigorous bounds in the setting of concatenated pulses. I would like to do it, as I mentioned. And I think that once that's done, then the bound will also reflect some tolerance to pulse errors. But having said that, of course, I mean, it's perfectly understood that something like dynamical decoupling, which is an open loop procedure, it cannot really remove entropy. So you need to do more. You need to do some kind of closed loop, introduce fresh ancillas, dump the entropy into the ancillas, like in fault-tolerant error correction, in order to get this procedure to really be scalable. But as a first step, maybe this is not too bad.
Any more questions? Okay. Then I have many questions. So let's spend time with speaker.
Thank you.